It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. Shortly, we'll speak with Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett about the city's residential requirement for public workers.
First, though, a nonprofit restaurant that helps train military veterans in food service work had its grand opening this afternoon in Milwaukee. Chuck Kornbach visited the kitchen of Troop Cafe and has this report.
It's just a short while before dozens of guests are expecting lunch, and Rick Crutchen is standing over a large container of coleslaw. He's spooning some into empty serving cups.
It's really a great side item that we have, very popular, so we're just trying to make it look nice.
Crutchen is a Navy veteran and one of about a half dozen vets who are completing a six-month training program at Troop Cafe. The small restaurant on Milwaukee's Near West Side opened back in May to test things out before today's grand opening. Crutchen says the things he's learned in the kitchen and connections he's made have helped him become a lead cook at another local restaurant.
Being new to the area, I thought it would be a good way to help get myself established up here and network.
Helping Crutchen with the coleslaw is a newer trainee, John Skeens, who has served in the Marines and is still on reserve status. Skeen says he's learned a lot about preparing food.
I really love cooking and baking, and it's helped me to refine my knife cutting skills.
Your knife cutting skills?
Yeah, being able to... that kind of thing. Dicing and mincing and whatnot.
The kitchen trainees follow the orders of executive chef and general manager Greg Bautista.
All right, Rick, I'm looking at like maybe 8 minutes, and I'm going to call out the hot food, right?
Bautista did not serve in the military, but says he believes in the mission of job training for veterans.
And it's something that I've been looking for. I've been in food service for like 32 years now, so it's a very rewarding, a pleasure to work with the guys and see them progress as they come through our program.
Marine veteran Christopher Kadrich is another manager at Troop Cafe. He also says he takes great pride in helping veterans learn some skills. He says the biggest challenge is that some vets aren't quite able to handle the training.
In order to really get through this program, you have to be a little bit stable and on your feet. So I think my biggest challenge is just not being able to save the world at once.
Kadrich says some veterans struggle.
Whether it be codependency or there's a lot of really, really powerful issues that need to be addressed. Now, the great news is that the Center for Veterans Issues handles all of those things at a ground floor level.
The Center for Veterans Issues is a Milwaukee-based agency that also runs a housing program in Vets Manor, the building in which Troop Cafe operates. Center President Robert Cocroft says he's happy with how Troop Cafe is doing. He says the veterans being helped are not just from the Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts, but go all the way back to the Vietnam era.
We have older veterans who, for one reason or another, have not been able to maintain continuous employment, but a lot of them are unemployed just due to market factors.
Cocroft says the restaurant also tries to help a mostly low-income part of the city.
We receive requests from the community to provide an eating establishment for the neighborhood because this is sort of a food desert. There aren't a lot of places that are wholesome.
Some other restaurants in this part of Milwaukee have not survived the marketplace, but Troop Cafe has a mix of public sector and private sector support and a sense of urgency, including from Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett.
We have to do something as a city to embrace veterans and tell them right here at one of the most busy intersections in this city, we honor veterans.
Troop Cafe is open from 6:30 in the morning until 3 in the afternoon. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio in Milwaukee.
Thanks, Chuck. And now we continue our coverage out of Milwaukee. This summer, Governor Walker signed legislation that barred Milwaukee from enforcing its residential requirement for city employees. Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett has been fighting to reverse that legislation.
On Monday, Mayor Barrett filed an affidavit citing research that showed that 60% of Milwaukee's city workers would leave the city limits during the next 11 years if the rule ended.
Here with us to talk about the residency requirement is Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett. Mayor Barrett, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be back.
Well, the city is currently defending its ability to enforce a residency rule for city workers. Where does that lawsuit stand right now?
Well, the briefs will be filed. If they haven't been filed this week, they will be filed very, very soon. And there is oral argument set on the motions for summary judgment, which are the motions to really resolve the lawsuit by both sides, in late January. So there still is another month or two of responses and replies to briefs. But the first briefs by both parties have been filed, or again, will be filed shortly.
Well, in an affidavit that you filed on Monday, I think, you talked about a study that found 60% of city workers would be likely to leave the city if the residency rule ends. Can you tell us something about that study and what it found?
Well, it looked at other cities that have enacted residency rules and have made an estimate based on the activities that have occurred in other major American cities as to what would happen. The underlying issue here is really the Wisconsin state constitution. And we feel very strongly that we are defending the Wisconsin state constitution that gives cities and villages, such as the city of Milwaukee, the ability to regulate what's known as local affairs. And we believe that that provision of the Constitution applies in this case. The Home Rule Amendment, which is in Article 11, Section 3 of the Wisconsin Constitution, we believe applies here.
Now, the city commissioned this study, as I understand it. It cost almost $70,000. This is something you feel passionately about. I wonder if you could talk a bit about what's at stake here for Milwaukee in particular.
Well, obviously, I feel very, very strongly that this is an issue that needs to be decided at the local level. And what has happened in the history of this is back in the 1920s, there was an amendment added to the state's constitution. Again, it's called the Home Rule Amendment, and it's very clearly and expressly carves out for cities and villages the ability to regulate local affairs. And what followed after that was in 1938, the city of Milwaukee passed an ordinance that maintains this, that people who work for the city must maintain residence in the city of Milwaukee. And that has been undisturbed for 75 years, for three quarters of a century. So all the legislative elections, all the gubernatorial elections that have taken place from 1938 have honored that decision, until we get to this legislature and this governor. And they decided that they were going to take away the ability for local governments, local cities and villages, to regulate their own residency requirements. And the city of Milwaukee is not the only one that has one. There are literally dozens and dozens of residency requirements throughout the state of Wisconsin. So this doesn't have an impact only on the city of Milwaukee, but it certainly does have an impact on the city of Milwaukee.
Now, what was the initial goal in having that residency requirement in place?
Well, it's an understanding that the city of Milwaukee, and again, other communities have this, is offering good jobs, good family-supporting jobs, and in exchange for that, for a variety of reasons, some of them related to public safety. For example, you want to make sure that your police officers and your firefighters and your snowplow operators are close to work so that they can respond in emergency. That certainly is one of the impetuses for this. But then you've got other things like property values and to ensure that you've got a good, solid middle class in the city, people who get their paychecks from the city, that they're part of it. And then there are the intangibles, things like having firefighters or police officers be Cub Scout leaders or Girl Scout leaders or involved in church activities in the city where they're role models and they're active participants in city life. And all of those, I think, are valid. But the underlying issue here is it the right of the state of Wisconsin to take away what has been in place for 75 years at the local level?
Now, at this point, you said this is being kind of going back and forth right now. We don't know where it stands. But can city workers right now choose to live outside the city, or do they have to wait for the lawsuit to be decided?
Well, what we have said is that we are not going to fire anybody during the pendency of this lawsuit if they move out of the city. What happened following the passage of the state law was the city of Milwaukee, the Common Council, passed an ordinance which in essence reaffirmed the decision that was made in 1938, saying we believe that our statute is a legitimate statute. We enacted it in 1938. There's nothing that makes us think that this is a violation of any constitutional provision. In fact, we think that the action taken by the legislature and the governor violates the state constitution. In response to that, two unions have filed suit. One filed and then another joined the lawsuit against the city of Milwaukee. What we said is, during the pendency of this lawsuit, we won't fire anyone. Of course, if someone moves out, they're moving out at their own peril, because if we win this lawsuit, we certainly are going to enforce our residency requirement for those people who have moved out during the pendency of the lawsuit. So I would say if I were a city employee and I wanted to move out of the city, I would be very, very careful knowing that if you move out and the city wins this lawsuit, you're going to have to turn around and you're going to have to move or you're going to lose your job.
Now, you talked about how this law has been in place for 75 years. It's got quite a history behind it. Why did Governor Walker and the legislature decide to repeal it?
Oh, it's all politics. There's no question that it's a political payoff to the police and fire unions here in the city of Milwaukee who have supported him in his campaigns for governor. And he's given them a gift. It's a political gift. There's just no doubt about that.
Well, you've had a pretty public, topsy-turvy relationship with Governor Walker, especially in the wake of the high-speed rail money that Wisconsin declined. How has this latest battle affected your relationship with Governor Walker?
Oh, I think that we understand that there are issues that we're going to agree on, and there's issues that we're going to disagree on. There have been places where we have worked together, but this is one that not only I, but I can tell you that our common council feels very, very passionately that this is an issue, again, that for three quarters of a century has been respected by every legislature, every governor, until right now.
Well, right now we're speaking with Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett about the ongoing lawsuit over Milwaukee's residency requirement.
And we'd like to hear from you. What do you think about this requirement? Are you a city worker? Would you like to be able to move outside of city limits? Do you agree about the constitutional issue here or disagree? Or do you have a question about this? Call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
We'll take your calls coming up. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time.
We're back now with Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett talking about residency requirements in Milwaukee.
And we'd like to hear from you. What do you think about the requirement? Are you a city worker? Would you like to be able to move outside city limits? And do you have a question for Mayor Tom Barrett? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll go to our phones now. We have Tim with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Tim.
Hi, I just want to say I support the mayor's position, and I think that tax dollars that are raised from city residents that pay the salaries of city workers should stay within the city limits as much as possible. It's important, and it's part of the value that one expects when they pay their property taxes. So keep fighting, Mayor.
All right. Thank you, Tim. What do you think, Mayor Barrett?
And I appreciate that. And another issue here that I think is important to lay out is particularly when you look at the issues of the police department and the fire department, it's not as though we have a shortage of applicants. And in fact, we have literally thousands of applications pending for both the fire department and the police department. And so my view is, look, if you work for the city and you don't want to work for the city, I understand that. I mean, there are different reasons why people may not want to work for the city or live in the city. And you can choose to move and you can live in another community and work for another community. And I know that I have, for the fire department, probably 5,000 people who want your job. Or if you work for the police department, I know that I've got 3,000 people that want your job. So the whole notion of personal freedom, sure, people should be free to live where they want to. And the city should be free to hire people who want to live in the city.
And what about the issue of pensions? Did that come up in the study?
Well, the pension issue is obviously a real issue here, because the pensions are very healthy pensions. And again, for the fire and police officers, many of them can retire in their 40s. And so our view is, look, we give a great opening salary. There's chances for promotions. There is a good pension. There's good health care. And in return, we're saying we want you to be part of the community. And we don't apologize for that. We think it's worked very, very well for 75 years, and we don't think that a political payoff should reverse that.
You know, I know you'd be channeling the other side here, but what are some of the reasons that, you know, police officers or firefighters would want to leave Milwaukee?
Well, they may have a horse farm, or they may want their kids to go to a different school, or they may not like the city of Milwaukee. I mean, there are many reasons why someone may choose to live somewhere else, and they're all valid reasons. And I don't disparage someone for any of those reasons, but that doesn't mean that they have to continue to work for the city. And it's not as though we've sprung this on anyone. For 75 years, people knew what the rules of the game are. And every single person who has taken a job for the city knows that the requirement is that you live within the community. Every single one. So it's not as though someone has duped anyone. It's just that they decide, well, now we've got the political clout, let's change the rules.
All right, let's go back to the phone. Stephen joins us next in Milwaukee. Hi, Stephen.
Hello.
Hi, what do you think?
I think the whole thing is taking the municipal rights away, but it also kind of like the municipalities taking the rights of the citizens away, and if they want to reinstate it, I think it should go down to a public referendum.
All right, interesting thought. What about a referendum, Mayor Barrett?
Again, we've had referendums in the city of Milwaukee and through elections. We have had, if you think back 75 years, it's probably 18 different elections, and this issue can come up. It can come up, and if the people of the city of Milwaukee don't want their employees to have as a condition of an employment they reside in the city, that can be advanced at the city council level. And what has happened is there are other communities who have changed this. And for various reasons, it might be the cost of housing is too high in the community so that they understand that their police and fire can't afford to live there. They may decide that they do have a shortage of applicants for positions, and so they want to give some leeway. They might have geographic restrictions or restrictions for certain employees. That's what's so amazing about this, is that you have over 100 communities that in one fashion or another, and not all in the same fashion, have addressed the issue of residency. And it has always, always, always been done at the local level until now.
I want to go back to the phones. Jerry is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a brief comment. You know, I agree in the situation that if you're going to be a police or a firefighter in the city of Milwaukee, it's really a small price to pay to live in the city that you also work in and the city that employs you. And really, the city isn't that bad to begin with. There are a lot of great parts about the city. So, you know, I don't think it's necessary for the state to stick its hand in and try to make a change like this.
Okay, thanks, Jerry.
Well, Jerry, I appreciate that. That's one of the things that on occasion I'll have someone who'll say, oh, so-and-so has to live in the city. And my response is, no, no, no. They get to live in the city. They get to live in the city, and they get a great middle-class, family-supporting job with good health benefits and a good pension. And so it's a relationship. And just like other relationships, if someone wants to leave the relationship, they leave the relationship. But you just don't go in and willy-nilly reverse something that's been in place 75 years because you want to pay back a political favor.
Now, some people are city people, and some people like a little more space, might like that life in the suburb. Should they be able, you know, to do that, given that, you know, the economy is tough right now? They might not be able to find a comparable job somewhere else.
That's just people make decisions. They make choices in their lives. And that's a choice that individuals need to make. If they want a higher paying job and they move into the city, then there's going to be trade-offs to that. If they want to live 100 miles away from the city and not have much of an income, that's a decision they're going to make. And I don't begrudge them for that. Again, I don't think, though, that the people in the city of Milwaukee should be forced to support that lifestyle if they don't want to be part of the community.
All right, I think we have time for one more quick call. Diane next in Franklin. Hi, Diane.
Hi, I just wanted to make the comment that I do think that the people that are our firefighters and police officers should live in the city of Milwaukee. There is a certain comfort, I think, that you get knowing that the people that are going to fight your fires or be there to support you in a time of need, there is a comfort getting to know some of those individuals and having them as your neighbors, I think, is a great comfort. There's not a lot of people that children can look up to nowadays, and I realize that there is a lot of things going on with firemen and policemen nowadays. But when kids are small, I think that there's still a time for them to be able to look up to these individuals, and I think we should take that opportunity and just grab it and go with it and try to develop good relationships with them so that they know that police officers are good people and not somebody to be afraid of.
All right. Thank you for that comment, Diane. And Mayor Barrett, we've got about a minute left. What's
your
response?
I think Diane makes a great point there. And I can tell you, I go to a lot of schools, and I'm with a lot of little kids, and if there's a police officer there or there's a firefighter there, that police officer or that firefighter, they're the star. They're the star. For the little kids, little kids, obviously, and even many adults, look up to police officers and firefighters. They are great role models. And so naturally, we want to have the role models as part of our community, that we want kids to look up and say, well, maybe someday I could be a firefighter. Maybe someday I could be a police officer. But if they don't live in your community, then you're thinking, well, they don't live here. How can a young kid that you want to have be in a situation where they can dream of reaching this aspiration, how can they really truly dream that if they don't see it in their life? And that's part of this as well. That's not an economic factor, but it certainly is a real-world factor here as well.
All right. Well, Mayor Barrett, thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you very, very much.
We've been talking to Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett.
Coming up next is the news. Then we'll take a look at the results of yesterday's state and local elections around the country and figure out if they mean something for the future. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. We're talking to a political scientist about some of last night's elections. The biggest news out of the results were the gubernatorial elections in Virginia and New Jersey and the mayoral election in New York City.
Here to talk about these results and what they mean for Democrats and Republicans in future elections is Kyle Kondik. He's managing editor of Sabatow's Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia Center for Politics. Kyle, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So one of the closest races yesterday in your neck of the woods in Virginia, the race for governor, Democrat Terry McAuliffe beat Republican Ken Cuccinelli. What can we take away from the results there?
Well, this was a really fascinating race to watch because McAuliffe and Cuccinelli were unusually unpopular candidates. Both of them had generally had their favorability or their unfavorability numbers were higher than their favorability numbers. And that both are kind of figures that I think people who follow politics know nationally. Ken Cuccinelli was kind of a controversial state attorney general here in Virginia, and Terry McAuliffe is the chief fundraiser for the Clintons and a former chairman of the Democratic National Committee. And the contrast between essentially a professional fundraiser and a pretty strident social conservative turned off a lot of voters. There was a kind of unknown libertarian candidate who got about 6.5% of the vote, which is pretty high in Virginia for a third-party candidate, and I think that showed the general dissatisfaction with the two choices.
A lot of eyes on Virginia yesterday. It's a swing state in presidential elections. It's a really interesting contrast between urban areas and rural areas. Do people around the country look at this as maybe a little laboratory for a congressional election, a presidential election?
Yeah, I think they do, and I think to a certain extent they're right to do so. Virginia, of all 50 states, Virginia was actually closest to the national presidential voting in 2008 and 2012. So it was kind of the midpoint of the election in both elections. And I think naturally people are looking at it. And, you know, here's the other thing. You know, most political reporters are in Washington, D.C. A lot of them live in Virginia, and so they care a lot about what's going on in their backyard.
It's local news for them.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the other thing, too, is that this was only one of two gubernatorial races. The other one was in New Jersey where, you know, Chris Christie is a huge national figure, but that race was very, very uncompetitive, and the Virginia one was pretty competitive and actually was a little bit closer than the polls indicated on election night.
Well, and the two different sides at various points in that election were trying to make it a referendum on national issues, trying to blame Republicans on the one hand for the government shutdown, blaming the Democratic candidate, linking him to the Affordable Care Act and the troubled release so far. Is that something, as far as you could tell, that voters in Virginia were paying attention to?
Yeah, I think they were, although what was interesting about this race is that even though the polls were kind of weren't really right, they didn't move a ton during October. I think that this race was pretty steady since the late summertime, and I think that was sort of this. I think even though we had these big national events happening in Washington, I don't know if they necessarily moved the numbers all that much. Although it may be fair to say that a number of Republicans sort of came home to Ken Cuccinelli, perhaps as a result of the bad Obamacare rollout. That may have cost McAuliffe a point or two when it was all said and done.
Before we travel up to New Jersey, is there a tendency to maybe overread an election like this in an odd-numbered year, and it's one of the few data points we have, and we over-extrapolate from this one unique case?
That is an excellent point, and I couldn't have said it better myself. You know, there definitely is a tendency, again, because the Virginia gubernatorial race is one of the only games in town for people to look at. You sometimes see this same dynamic in special congressional elections when, you know, you'll have a special election in, you know, March of the election year or something, and something unexpected happens and people want to turn it into a national referendum and on what's going to happen. And the truth is, I think it's dangerous to do that, particularly in this Virginia race, because A, the midterm election is only is still a year away, and B, I think these candidates were unusually unpopular, and so it was a unique race that, while very interesting to cover, I don't necessarily know if it tells us a ton about what's going to happen next year.
Theoretically, both parties would elect more, I guess, likable candidates for president, say, in 2016.
Yeah, and that's a good transition to New Jersey.
Let's head up there. Yeah, so this was, Virginia was a close race. New Jersey, was it even a race at all?
I mean, you could make an argument that Christie was effectively unopposed. Barbara Buono is the Democrat who ran against him, but she had very little actual national party support, and there's a lot of big hitter Democrats in New Jersey that took a pass on this race. Most notably, Cory Booker, the former mayor of Newark, who is now in the U.S. Senate. He won a special Senate election a few weeks ago. And you know, Christie, even though New Jersey is a blue state, Christie is an unusually talented politician. I also think that his handling of Hurricane Sandy, which was a huge deal, of course, in New Jersey right before the presidential election last year, I think that was really helpful to Christie's favorability amongst voters. I mean, I think Christie was always going to win, but sometimes handling a natural disaster can be helpful to a politician if it's handled properly. We've seen that in some other places, and so, you know, you put all that stuff together, and it made for a very sleepy race, and all everybody cares about now with New Jersey and Christie is whether Christie's going to run for president.
Right.
I think he probably will, and he'll probably be a fairly significant contender on the Republican side.
Any signs from the numbers in that election or from his acceptance speech that might point toward that run?
Well, you know, he did really, really well, and he can, he can point to that and say, "Hey, I'm electable. I have crossover appeal." But I think there are a lot of Republicans who don't really like him all that much. Although it's really interesting that, you know, Christie was elected in 2009, and he became really notable to, I would say, conservative Republicans because of these viral videos that he made of him basically picking fights with teachers' unions and that sort of thing. It's actually kind of similar to your governor of Wisconsin, Scott Walker. Became kind of a folk hero to people who basically wanted to shrink the size of government and reduce the power of public sector unions. But during Hurricane Sandy, Christie was seen as being too close to President Obama, which, while I think probably helpful back home in New Jersey, I think turned off a lot of Republicans. And so I think if you would ask Republicans who they think is more conservative and better aligns with their principles, I think a lot of Republicans would say Scott Walker aligns better with them than Chris Christie.
Well, and that's one of the threads of reaction to this has been, look, a Tea Party affiliated guy lost in Virginia, a moderate won handily in a state that votes Democrat in presidential elections. Is there any kind of lesson there, or are these such unique cases that it's hard to learn anything?
I think the lesson from Virginia, well, let's put it this way. If Chris Christie were on the ballot in Virginia, I think he would have been elected governor. I also think that Bill Bowling, who your listeners probably have never heard of, but he's the lieutenant governor of Virginia, a Republican, and he was sort of seen as being next in line to run for governor, but Ken Cuccinelli basically cut in front of him, and that's politics, and Cuccinelli got the nomination. I think if Bowling had been nominated Virginia, maybe he'd be the next governor of Virginia. And Bowling is sort of a more he's more acceptable to the business crowd here. And while not really moderate, I don't know if Christie's really moderate either. They aren't as obviously socially conservative as Cuccinelli is.
Just real briefly, just about out of time, I don't want to leave out New York City, first Democratic mayor in 20 years. Any lessons there for Democrats?
You know, it's interesting that Bill de Blasio won in New York, and also the probably more liberal, labor-oriented candidate also won the mayoral election in Boston. And I think that after 20 years of voters in New York City sort of voting for these moderate business Republicans, you know, they decided to sort of go to their roots as being a very Democratic city and voting for, you know, a pretty liberal mayoral candidate. One of the most liberal mayors of New York City, at least in recent history. So, we'll have to see. But I think a lot of it is just, New York City is a very liberal Democratic city, and for the first time in 20 years, it voted its reputation.
Kyle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thank you.
That's Kyle Condick. He's managing editor of Sabato's Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia Center for Politics. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Our next guest says America is in a state of denial when it comes to football. While two recent documentaries have shed light on the game's concussion crisis, he says it's back to business as usual for coaches, players, and parents.
And he says what we need now is a national town hall meeting on the game to collectively address the health problems football creates.
Joining us now is Ken Reed, Sports Policy Director at League of Fans. Ken, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you.
So the documentaries I mentioned, United States of Football, League of Denial, two documentaries that tried to shine some light on concussions in football. Were they successful? Did they get us talking?
Well, I think there's generally a little more awareness across the country on the issue of brain trauma in general and concussions in particular in football, but it hasn't moved from awareness to understanding to attitude change and behavior change. I think it's back to business as usual and all the way down to the little leagues, which is pretty dangerous in my mind.
It's your sense that people maybe saw the documentary or heard about it, said, oh, that's a shame, that's too bad, and then went back to watching, coaching, participating as they always did.
Well, we're in a unique situation here because there's little doubt that football is America's favorite sport, and there's also little doubt today that football is hazardous to the human brain. So the issue is, how can we reconcile those two facts, and can they be reconciled? And I think at the very least, we need to have a serious discussion about football for our kids, because kids' brains are even more vulnerable than adults. They're still developing, and the risks are even higher.
What do we know about the impact of football and the impact of these injuries on young people in the U.S.?
Well, there's a lot of research out there. Just one thing that I'll throw out is that in any given season of high school football, 20% of the players sustain a brain injury. And even scarier than that is because these schools don't have trainers and doctors to the degree that college and NFL teams do, that 40.5% of these high school athletes who suffer concussions return to action prematurely. And that's really dangerous because then you can get second impact syndrome, which can shut down the brain, basically, and sometimes result in death.
You know, I don't know. I know there's Pee Wee football. How young are kids starting playing tackle football?
6 or 7 years old. And one of the deals with the kids that young is if you go watch one of the games, it's kind of cute because they're not going that fast and it looks like they're kind of just hugging each other. But in reality, the brain impact, in fact, there was a study done that showed the G-forces from Pee Wee football are very similar to adults. So
really?
It's dangerous. Yeah, even at that young a level when they're not hitting each other that hard, they're still suffering a lot of damage.
Well, and then there's the idea, or probably the fact, that kids' brains are still growing and developing and therefore more vulnerable. Is that part of why you want to start focusing on this younger level?
Well, yeah, that plus the fact that there's over 3 million kids playing youth football and over 1 million kids playing high school football. So the numbers are just humongous relative to the number of people playing college and NFL football. So I think the fact that we have that many kids playing football and the fact that Their brains are more vulnerable as they're developing, and their necks aren't as strong, which leads to more of the whiplash effect, that we definitely need to shift the focus to the younger kids.
Well, before we get to how you want to change that focus, there is the argument that, you know, there are positives of football. The teamwork, the exercise, camaraderie. Yes, there are some risks, but the positives outweigh those negatives. How would you answer that?
Well, I think those are legitimate positives. And just to clarify, I played 6 years of football myself. My dad was a football coach. I still enjoy watching the game, although it's harder knowing what's going on with inside their skulls. But I'm not anti-sports at all. I'm just looking at something that is real here, just like when we were looking at smoking in high schools, you know, and we banned that. I think the same thing needs to be discussed. Well, what are we going to do with football in our youth? And what's troubling to me is the research I've looked at is there's no magic bullet out there. There's not a helmet that can be designed that's going to protect our brains, because helmets were designed to protect skull fractures, and they do a good job with that. But in terms of the brain, it's like Jell-O inside of a bowl, and when you get hit, whether it's in the head directly or even in the chest, it's a whiplash effect, and the brain smashes against the side of the skull, and that's what actually causes the concussion. So there's not a helmet that's going to protect that brain from smashing against the side of the skull.
You recently wrote that we need a national town hall meeting to talk about the issues you're raising here. What would that look like? What are you hoping it could accomplish?
Well, as we started this conversation, there are some great documentaries out there. There's been some articles written. People are more aware, but it stops there. It's like we're really in a state of denial. We just go back to how things were. I think what we need is a national town hall, and I think ideally ESPN would be the host of that. It could be sponsored by the Pro League, NFL, and other football organizations. And it's not just football. It's other sports that are dealing with this too. But ESPN in particular, because they were working on the documentary called League of Denial and backed out at the last second. So I kind of think that you know, they obviously did it for business reasons. NFL is a big business partner, but I think they owe it to the country as journalists to at least spend an hour on a national town hall to discuss this issue.
We've got a caller. We've got John in Windsor with us. John, hi. What do you think about this?
Well, I think that it's not just football that you need to have it take a look at studying. I mean, soccer, for instance, is there are huge brain injuries in soccer because, you know, in that sport, people inherently use their head, which is not used, does not have a helmet, to head the ball into the goal. You know, field hockey, another one. Of course, regular hockey. So I don't think that this is just something that you can say football is the main problem. And I had to say, I played football in high school, and I think that I may have suffered a concussion. That was 35 years ago. But, you know, I think that this is inherent in almost all sports that people are involved with.
All right, John, thanks. So, Ken, you briefly mentioned this should expand to other sports. Is there a case to be made, though, for having a main focus initially on football?
Well, football, I mean, if you look at the stats, to the caller's point, there are concussions, obviously, that occur in other sports. But football, by far, per capita, number of players, has the most concussions. Now, soccer, especially for girls, would be second. Hockey, obviously, but football by far is the main sport that causes the most concussions. And it's also the sport where violently striking the opponent is a key part of the game. Now, with soccer, the headers can be banned for, you know, for kids 14 and under, and you can still have a game that looks an awful lot like soccer. Hockey, you can cut back on the fighting, you can eliminate fighting, you can get rid of some of the cheap shots along the board, then it still looks like hockey. But if you take out the violence in football, unless you go to flag football, it's not the same sport. So it's a bigger issue that we have to deal with at football.
So what would success look like to you in terms of this national town hall meeting or changing the conversation? What kind of changes on the ground, on the football field for kids would you like to see?
Well, I think the conversation, the town hall, would include medical doctors and researchers, youth sports organizers, all the way up to the NFL. So we get a well-rounded panel discussion going. But I think ultimately, in my view, what's got to happen is we got to have much less contact in practices. You can limit tackling and blocking and things like that. Even the NFL's gone to very limited contact during the week. A big thing is that there's got to be strict return-to-play guidelines. If there's any sign of a concussion at all, the kid needs to be pulled out and sent to a doctor and cleared by a doctor before they can go back into action. And then I think we just got to look at the bigger picture of the rules of football. I mean, is there a way where we could have linemen standing up and so they're not banging directly head-to-head? You know, obviously we're in NFL and college, we're already trying to get rid of spearing where they're leading with a head. So there's a lot of things like that that can be done to make it incrementally safer. But the question is whether you can get there and make it safe enough to protect the brain, especially in young kids. I truly think high school football in the next decade is in danger if for no other reason that more research comes out. There's going to be more lawsuits, and with more lawsuits means the insurance costs for school districts to sponsor something like football are going to be cost prohibitive, and they might have to drop it.
All right, Ken, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
That's Ken Reed, Sports Policy Director at League of Fans. That's a sports reform project.